go. If you'll remember, several weeks ago when we first started, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the structure of the Elijah narratives in 1st and 2nd Kings. And in particular, we talked about some of the underlying structure between not only the narratives, but chapters 17 through 19, and then more specifically, more narrow, 17 through 18. And then I talked about some of the even more narrow structure that we find in certain parts. And when we're looking through chapter 17 and 18, the structure of that, you'll see we're in sub B prime, basically. If it's like a chiasm, it would be almost, you know, the last two. And what's interesting here is that this B prime is only one sentence, but it meets all the requirements to be a section, because it, you can see the parallelism. And what you're going to see here is some little, I'll show you a few little tiny neat little features in the text that you can see what the author's doing. If you'll remember back, I'll pull it back to that page real quick. There is, if we look back at this level of division, when you compare chapter 17, 18, and 19, all three of those are kind of like an act. They have similar elements to them, right? And you see that repetitive pattern. It happens over such a long distance over the course of a chapter that you don't really put it together. But the more you read over it, you can tell where you're at in that progression of events. And so you see this mirroring happening here in the storytelling between those three different chapters. And we're down here, you know, towards the very end of chapter 18, but there's a thematic undercurrent in the text. And it's not on the surface, it's not something you're picking up, but the more you read it and the more you're made aware of it, you can see the parallelism in the underlying themes that are going on. And so we're down here, and you'll see, even though this may just be one verse, it is mirroring what's happened before. And so, it's going to serve a big purpose. And then the final section as well. So if we looked at this little graph, you know, we're here in the purple. Elijah sends the prophets and destroys them, the prophets of Baal at Wadi Karib. Well, the thematic reference of that earlier on was Yahweh sent and provides for Elijah at Wadi Karib instead of Wadi Kishon. You see the thematic parallelism here? It's almost like using characters and actions and events, he's setting up a parallel, a kind of an undercurrent, a thematic parallel. And then what we had in 17:1, Elijah predicts the drought, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of this, Elijah will predict the rain, and Yahweh will send the rain. Do you see the mirroring, the image, the mirroring of the theme of the text? And that's why these two chapters, okay, even though they're part of this larger three-chapter structure, are often considered to be a unit of themselves, a unit within a unit. And that is pretty neat. So we're going to see this entire section kind of, if you're looking at a plot line in Scripture, you know, you have tension is introduced in the text. You have your introduction of your characters, and you get the basic features of a story. And you see the tension rise, right? And then you're going to have the plot thickens and it intensifies, and you have plot resolution, denouement, right? And so what you're seeing here is you're going to see when Yahweh provides the rain, you're going to see that first initial plot of the drought, the promise of the drought, and Yahweh sending the drought. You're going to see the tension from that. You're going to see it resolve. But then you're going to see immediately a new tension enter into the narrative, right? And so the end of this story, not only does it provide resolution for the first thematic plot, but it also provides kind of a point of departure to introduce the tension for the next portion of the narrative. And that's chapter 19. And we're not going to get to go through it, but I just kind of wanted you to see those kind of those big literary features, kind of what's going on. And this is where we're at here. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm just going to read this first verse here, verse 40. And I'm on page 57. And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape." And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, the Wadi Kishon, and slaughtered them there. So, just a couple of quick notes. Here, a lot of commentators disagree over the moral judgment in Elijah's slaughtering of the prophets of Baal. Just one commentator, Nelson, suggests that Elijah acted rightfully in accordance with Deuteronomistic principles in Deuteronomy, and that this was justified because, in a sense, it offset Jezebel's murder of the prophets of Yahweh. Okay? Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Where there could be some people argue, there's justification. Was he right to do that? Did God authorize him to do it? Text doesn't say anything about Yahweh. The word of the Lord came to Elijah and said, destroy the prophets of Baal. Now, you could argue that there's biblical precedent for it, but is he acting in accordance with God's, Another writer said Milgram, and if you can't tell, I'm using Milgram several times because he's kind of like the liberal critic, okay? And he's like, he's trying to show you just how bad Elijah is. And then there's another set of commentators like, no, Elijah is over here. You know, where's the truth? You know, where is Elijah fit? Because you have voices, you read any number of commentators, you have voices on both ends of the spectrum, Elijah, right? Well, this guy's on the far left, and he's tearing Elijah up. So he says, but he makes some points. He says, Elijah has triumphed, and success has gone to his head. He has no intention of being magnanimous in victory, no longer a powerless fugitive. In this brief moment in time, power has passed into his hands. The inflamed masses before him are malleable material, ready to be formed into a sword that can be wielded to his purposes. Elijah grasps the sword. He's a pretty good writer. He's not your typical commentator, right? So where is it? Where is the truth on Elijah, right? The narrator's been artfully reticent, right? And he has left this division in there. Or he's left this tension in there with Elijah's character. You see things that are no doubt great, and you see things that are questionable. And so hopefully you'll see some of this. I put some text here that may give some allusions to what we call antecedent Old Testament text, or Old Testament text that may be in the background of this. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that. I kind of want to move on to the next... next thing, put this here. So that takes us, that little short sentence, you can see it fills a structural purpose in the narrative as far as the story goes, but it gets us to the very last and closing segment of these two chapters, section A prime. And I'm just going to start by reading the text, and then we'll go through it. The Lord sends rain here on page 58. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain." So Ahab went up to eat and drink. And Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel. And he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look toward the sea." And he went up and looked and said, "There is nothing." And he said, "Go again, seven times." And at the seventh time, he said, "Behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea." And he said, "Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you." And in a little while, the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. Okay, so on the surface, that sounds pretty simple, right? You can track the the flow of events, nothing, right? Let's take one step below the surface and see what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So the narrator, note here, the narrator shifts the action from the banks of the Kishon, the Wadi Kishon, back to the heights of Carmel. You see it? The geographic change in the narrative. You see, it's one of the reasons we can make, there's a demarcation in the text. This is a different unit. So you see a narrative, you do it in the Gospels all the time, mm-hmm. right? Gospel of John, how many, we have three cycles back from Galilee to Judea and Jerusalem. Galilee, you know, so there's changes in the text, right? Geographically. So the action moves from the banks of Kishon back to Carmel, and Elijah has this brief dialogue with Ahab and then with his servant. And you see those command and prediction elements in here. Elijah's command and prediction to Ahab are kind of interesting here. The narrator never suggests that Elijah commanded the rain by his word. Remember in 17:1? There will not be rain except by my word. And then after that, the very next sentence, verse 2 in chapter 17, it says, and the word of the Lord came to. Remember that? So the jury's been out here on Elijah, what's going on? And all of a sudden, the rain comes, but the narrator never tells us that Elijah said a word. Right? So he never says that he commanded the rain by his word, but that there is the sound of the rushing of rain. That's what he says. Elijah says, oh, there's the sound of the rushing of rain. Then you'll notice the pace and the terseness of the dialogue between Elijah and his servant. Some say it may betray his impatience, Elijah's impatience. But it also reveals his commitment to prayer and his confidence that Yahweh will send the rain. You see the tension in there? Almost since the first, from chapter 17:1, when Elijah came onto the scene, there's this tension in the character of Elijah and what it should be, we think, and what it's kind of portrayed to be, or it's open to be interpreted as. And then it says, the people have responded to Yahweh, but has Ahab? If not, will he? Then this one commentator, Ollie, says, this suggests, this unit suggests that Ahab's eating and drinking was actually a reaffirmation of the covenant with the people. Eat and drink. This would suggest that Elijah, in light of the response of the people, believes that Ahab has been converted as well, and he instructs him to reaffirm his covenant obligations as king. Go up, eat and drink to the king. He's telling the king to go up and eat and drink, to reaffirm his covenant commitments and his responsibilities as the king of the people. Right? Is Elijah too optimistic or naive? The idea of the prophet running ahead of the king could also symbolize the prophet acting as the king's herald. In this light, it's interesting, Elijah would be heading straight for Jezreel. And Jezreel was a little, Samaria was the capital of Israel at the time, the northern kingdom. But Jezreel was a place where they had a little palace. And that's where Jezebel was, right? And I'm assuming she's still hiding all the prophets of Asherah at her table, right? Because they didn't apparently go up and get slaughtered. Only the prophets of Baal got slaughtered, right? They didn't show up like they were supposed to. Well, the king didn't make sure they were there. She said, no, I'm not sending my guys. You send your guys, right? So he's headed straight for Jezreel to herald the news to Jezebel in the king's court. The news of the slaughter of the prophets of Baal, which was a counterblow to Jezebel's pogrom, holy war, and the turning of the people toward Yahweh would have enraged Jezebel. And this primes the narrative for her vicious response in chapter 19, which we're not going to go into, but this primes the narrative with tension. Immediately after the tension in the first two chapters was resolved, all of this going on is showing you vivid imagery. Elijah believes that the people and now the king have turned, right, back to Yahweh. And he's going down to Jezreel to confront Jezebel and the prophets and her prophets of Asherah, right? And he is on a mission. And he is, how powerful, how empowered he feels, how vindicated by Yahweh, right? He has a divine mandate. He feels he's come off this great victory on the mountaintop, and he's going down to conquer for Yahweh's cause and turn the people and the nation back. He's already got the heart of the king. Now he has to get the king's wife, the queen. But, yes.
Is Jezebel the wife? Like, I've always heard she's just bad.
Yeah.
Is she the wife?
She's Ahab's wife, okay. And her dad was her dad was Ethbaal, king of Sidon, which is in just north of there, and basically chief of Baal worship, right? The center of Baal worship, and he married her, and she's got her prophets of Asherah, and she was supporting. They're basically trying to impose state-sponsored apostasy in Israel. Right, they're taking Yahweh away, and moving them towards Baal and Asherah, and Asherah was the consort of Baal, right? And so, you can see all this kind of going on in the background. And it says there's an interesting wordplay in these verses. The word down, yarad, is used in verses 40 and 44, and it brackets the word for up, Allah, which is used seven times in between. It's interesting that the derivation of the word of Allah occurs seven times in the covenant confirmation narrative of Exodus 24. This is a strong argument for allusion here to Exodus 24. And what was Exodus 24? It was the covenant was confirmed. I'm just going to read this little verse, two verses. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, right? And they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet as if it were a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. So a lot of writers are saying, hey, there is an allusion here to this text. And this is showing you that Elijah, at least in his mind, that this he has instructed the king to reenact a covenant renewal ceremony by eating and drinking after the conversion of the people when the fire came down. Their response, in that he is the king is back in his rightful place. You see, and there's an allusion here, and so when you see that, you can actually see that in here. And what I showed you, you can see I kind of highlighted it in this crosswalk. All of the occurrences of up. Did you notice the imagery? He went up and went down. He went up. If you weren't looking for it when I read that, the next time you read that, you're going to be, oh, he went up, he went down. He went up, he went down. He went up, he went down. I mean, what's going on? Well, it's a literary technique. And he is giving you an allusion to a prior text that gives context to this one. He's saying, look, this is a subtle way of saying, yeah, that's what he was doing. So it's a literary technique. He'll introduce a concept that might be a little bit vague, right? And then he's giving you a subtle hint later on in the text to say, yeah, he's referring back to this text, and that is what it was. That's what's going on in Elijah's mind. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty cool. He says, note also that Ahab precedes Elijah in his flight to Jezreel. So Ahab went down first, but Elijah, under the hand of the Lord, overtakes him. And this symbolizes the ideal order of the king following the prophet. This may suggest that Elijah had assumed too much and that Ahab was not yet converted, but conversely, that Elijah and Yahweh had not given up on him either. So I think if you think about it, you know, Elijah is in a hurry to go and just let Jezebel have it and put an end to this. And restore the kingdom, right? And now, you can see in his mind, now we're going to pull all 12 tribes back together. Because we only got, you know, 10 of them up here. And we're going to pull them all together, you know, like it's supposed to be. And just, you know, Ahab, does he really want to go to Jezreel? Does he really want to go down and face Jezebel right now? He probably was like, oh, I got to go. And then maybe he was relieved when Elijah went first. Maybe Jezebel will take care of him before I get there. I mean, I don't know. But you're starting to see some of the kind of... But the narrator is leaving that intention for us. Yeah. If we flip over to page 65, I just want to read this a little bit. And then we'll kind of close things up. Here on page 65, it's Elijah in retrospect. So we'll kind of reflect back on the whole two chapters, this whole study on Elijah so far. Elijah's character emerges through word and deed, comparison, dialogue, and a variety of rhetorical devices, portraying his capacity for change. Would you guys agree? Mm-hmm. All the different ways his character is explored. He is cast as a prototypical prophet, personifying the role, in, first of all, in chapter 17, in the ordinary private realm of everyday life and people, right? The Wadi Karit, the widow of Zarephath, right? In the private realm. But in chapter 18, he's in the public political sphere, dealing with the king, dealing with the court, right? Dealing with Obadiah. Elijah is a bold, determined, zealous servant of Yahweh who functions as a prophet, a miracle worker, a preacher, a political reformer, and he demonstrates faith and obedience to Yahweh and a life committed to prayer and biblical worship. I say that the text shows that, right? But at the same time, his self-absorption and his egocentricities rightly center the narrative on its primary protagonist, Yahweh, whose ways are more diverse than the single-minded thrust of Elijah's life. Elijah, it's all of us too, can it be, right? Elijah is zealous. He wants to make a difference. He wants to do something great. He wants God to do something great through him. And this could be okay things, right? But Elijah has a tendency to what? I and I alone am left. And if we read in chapter 19, you're going to see the same thing. He's going to say the same complaint to Yahweh on the mountain, right? Okay? If you read ahead, you see this. There's a pattern here, and it's showing you that the narrator has written this in such a way that by exploring the character of Elijah, his positive traits and his characteristic faults, right? He's showing you who the true protagonist of the story is. It's Yahweh, right? He goes, I and I alone, the only one. No, I have 7,000 others, right, who have not met the need of Baal. Right? He has a very narrow view. He's consumed with his own world and his own narrow slice of reality, right? And he's functioning and he's leaning into it. And you have to admire him. But he still has a limited perspective. God's still at work in the world, both in Israel and beyond, right? And he says, Yahweh, whose ways are more diverse than the single-minded thrust of Elijah's life. Nevertheless, it is evident that Yahweh continues to care for him, to use him, and to confirm his word. Any criticism is between Yahweh and Elijah. You notice that? The narrator never criticizes Elijah. We do when we read it, especially when someone says, hey, read this critically, right? Don't focus on the good stuff about Elijah. Look at the negative stuff. Thank you for the negative literary critics who do this because it helps us stay balanced here. But in the end, they get it wrong, right? But he says, any criticism is between Yahweh and Elijah. Within the narrative world, there's no public criticism. The narrator tells the story in a way that, while affirming the power of Yahweh, illustrates that confrontation and dramatic acts are not the only way forward. Yahweh didn't say, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, you know, put them to the test, put me to the test, do it on the place that's not a place where, you know, I mean, we start to question Elijah's means and his method and his authority to do some of the things he did, and he was outlandish and confrontational, and but yet Yahweh responds occasionally, right? Sometimes it's qualified. It says, there is a role for quiet, dedicated, and faithful service both inside and outside the land. And if we read chapter 19, you're going to see a whole lot more of that. Yahweh is not in the earthquake. He's not in the fire. He's not in the wind. But it's something like a still small voice. It's a moment of silence, right? he's at work in the world, and we're blessed to be a part of what he's doing, right? But it's almost like, hey, Elijah. But Elijah is lifted up. Elijah's taken off in a chariot of fire at the end of his, you know, career in the text. Right. I mean, so he, you see all these wonderful things, and yet you still see his faults. But all that that serves to do is give us a dose of reality and perspective and highlight the true protagonist. It's God that's at work in the world, right? Thank you, Elijah. I'm going to work in spite of your faults, in spite of your weaknesses and your failures. You know, so Elijah's not an enigma. Like the God we, the God he served, we can know him truly, but not completely. His character, like our own lives, demonstrates capacity for change, and therefore the need to evaluate his life retrospectively. And for Elijah, First Kings 17:18 is only the beginning. There are many more surprising aspects of his character yet to discover. I think, you know, you could at this point, you could probably go back and read. Go and read chapter 19 on your own, and you're going to be like, I can follow this now. This is the third time I've seen this progression in the narrative. I can see what's going on with Elijah, what Yahweh's doing. And then you're going to see at the end of chapter 19, we have this, we have the introduction to Elisha, right? The call, the commission of Elisha, and the beginning of the end for Elijah's ministry, although he'll reappear a couple more times. But is that helpful?
Yes.
Here on page 60, I'm just going to kind of give you, do I have time? Just a couple minutes. I put this together as I was looking at some of the key themes in here, and this section it exposes the core issue in the larger narrative, I think, of 1 Kings 17 and 18. This text here, 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 21. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. And remember I said, that's where we see the themes of justice and mercy come to the surface of the text. You see God's patience and his chesed, his covenant love, his covenant faithfulness to his people. You see his patience, his mercy, but you still see this concept of judgment that will not be dismissed, and it's all in the context of exclusive covenant loyalty. And if I put these texts in here together, I'll just read the headlines of them, or the kind of the subtitles. Yahweh is God, there is no other. Right? And I showed you some texts that point to that. All idolatry is vanity. The identity of the idol itself, like the Baal, doesn't really matter. God shares his glory with no one. There is one God, Yahweh, creator of heaven and earth. And Yahweh claims rightful title to his people and the primacy of their affections. As image bearers, we're called to love him with all of our hearts, souls, and minds. God is merciful, gracious, and loving, patient, long-suffering, and slow to anger. Yet Yahweh is also righteous and demands exclusive covenant loyalty. I think you see there are biblical texts, antecedent biblical texts. A couple of these are Isaiah or after the fact, but most of those are antecedent biblical texts where you're seeing the character, the nature of God and how he interacts with his covenant people and his covenant promises, and those key concepts about who he is and who he has called his people to be, you see those come to the surface in just these two chapters, I think. And so anyway, any questions on any of that? You guys see where the word for down and up comes in, and down, down brackets that, actually. So down's here, then you got seven occurrences of the word for Allah for up, and then you have down again. And he's just showing, hey, there's seven of these, just like we had, and he's sending him up seven times. And
what are you doing after this? What's next? what are we doing?
Well, we'll probably continue on for a time,
okay.
Going through the rest of the Old Testament.
Oh,
okay.
But this was great. Oh, great. Appreciate you guys sticking with it. I hope it was helpful.
No, I've never...
Hey, I've